Welcome to this official AES podcast, coming to you from the Novotel Exhibition Centre in Hammersmith, London, where the 128th Convention of the AES is taking place from Saturday, May the 22nd, to Tuesday, May the 25th. I'm attending all 4 days of the convention, so the AES asked me to record my impressions of the show as it progresses. As far back as anyone can remember, AES conventions have consisted of two halves: the conference sessions, in which new technologies and theoretical techniques are presented to the gathered representatives of the pro audio industry in technical sessions and seminars, and the exhibition, in which manufacturers take stands in a hall and show visitors to the AES some of their latest new products. Broadly speaking, you could say that the conferences present new theories and technologies to the industry, and the exhibition shows those technologies in a commercial form. For my sins, I've been interested in audio and recording technology since I was 11, so I've tended to come to the AES for new products in the exhibition in the past, but this year I'm hoping to check out some of the seminars and presentations too. There are some amazing producers and engineers speaking here, like George Massenberg, Steve Lipson, Phil Harding, Chuck Ainley and John Kelly, and one of my all-time production heroes, Sir George Martin, is receiving an honorary membership of the AES on the final day of the show. Today's the first day of the convention, and traditionally these are always conference-only days. So, as I sit here in the press office on the mezzanine level of the convention centre, the exhibitors are setting up their stands downstairs in the exhibition hall in readiness for the opening of the exhibition tomorrow. The conferences have only been open an hour or so, and the registration desks at the convention centre entrance have been absolutely packed. When I arrived, the registration queues were full of visitors from all over the world. You only had to listen to the accents. I began my tour of the convention by bumping into this year's chairman, Josh Rice, in the entrance lobby, and he kindly agreed to give me my first interview. Josh is a lecturer with the Centre for Digital Music and the Digital Signal Processing Group in the Electronic Engineering Department at Queen Mary, University of London, and is a long-standing member of the AES, although this is his first year as convention chair. I started by asking him what his hopes were for the show on the morning of the opening.
Yeah, well, I hope we live up to all the expectations. It should be a fantastic show. We're expecting huge numbers, more than is typical for a European convention, and really showing that the industry is very much alive, active, and dynamic at the moment. And the convention program is just packed full of interesting talks, workshops, panels, a completely full exhibition hall, and loads of interesting speakers.
Absolutely. One thing that has particularly struck me this year looking at the completed programme for the convention is not only a mixture of the usual scientific breakthroughs being presented in the form of papers and presentations, but also a really excellent practical mix. For example, seminars on how to keep studios alive in the current challenging environment, a lot of really good producers and engineers coming to talk to people at the exhibition. That seems to me to be an extra dimension for this year's show.
Yeah, that's right. Although it's funny that you started that off by mentioning the usual scientific breakthroughs, which is one of the things that distinguishes AES conventions from many other conventions related to the recording industry.
Absolutely.
But here we've got a real fusion of practice, expertise, industry, academic, the recording industry, and the music business. So there's a lot of panel sessions throughout the convention that are joint between APRS and AES, and also some that are joint with MPG, the Music Producers Guild.
Indeed.
So this is bringing studio owners, record producers, and really well-known, established people on the practical side, people who have produced top-selling records and really know the trade very well. And getting them to talk to the engineers here, getting the up-and-coming engineers and the students to learn from them, and getting panels to discuss the issues that everyone's concerned with, you know, loudness issues, as an example, or dealing with data in the studio and things, but getting it from many different perspectives.
Absolutely.
From the perspective in the studio as well as behind the scenes.
So it's fair to say that this is a great show for a sort of interface between academia and the commercial aspect of the audio and recording industries.
Absolutely. That's really one of the things that distinguishes it. So, as you know, I come from an academic background, so this leads all of my research, hearing what industry are telling me are really the practical issues, what they would like to deal with. It's very important for me and my work that way, but it's also a great opportunity for people in industry to find out about what's the up-and-coming research, what's going to be in the record studio tomorrow, what are going to be the technologies that the companies are going to say look at and say, those are interesting ideas, can we build an application based on those ideas. So what you'll see at this convention are loads of groundbreaking new technologies being presented in the exhibition hall, and that came out of technical papers a year or two ago. And you'll also see things demonstrated or presented in the technical program that will become tomorrow's products in the exhibition hall in a convention or two later.
Absolutely. A quick question about visitors. I've just come from the entrance hall, and it was absolutely packed with people, coaches dropping busloads of students and visitors from abroad off it, it seemed to be at the moment, people arriving here coming from the show from Europe and from the States. It looks like it's a very buoyant start to the visitors. What are your hopes for visitor numbers at the show?
All the signs so far are good. Registration has been going on, and it's completely full with a queue, but a manageable queue. And the exhibition hall is completely sold out, all the floor space is taken. The convention has been widely promoted and talked about on online discussion forums, ones that we weren't even aware of.
Sure.
So the signs are all good. So my hope is not just that the convention will be busy, I know that's going to be the case, but that everyone comes away from here with good ideas, with pockets full of business cards and loads of email addresses exchanged, basically having a good time and an interesting time.
Thanks very much, Josh Rice.
You're welcome.
Cheers.
I spent most of the first day at the convention checking out some of the conference presentations. Some of the conference rooms were particularly impressive. Suite C1 and C3 upstairs, for example. And C1 featured the kind of 5.1 surround monitoring system you only get in top-flight mastering studios like Metropolis. In fact, Metropolis isn't far away from the convention centre, so perhaps that's where they got the idea. And it was an appropriate choice, as one of the most interesting presentations on the afternoon of the first day was on mastering for surround. Suite C3 was the venue for the opening ceremonies of the convention in the early afternoon, where AES President Dima De Vries welcomed everybody to the convention and gave thanks that the Icelandic ash cloud had not interfered with everyone arriving. Although convention chairman Josh Rice pointed out that it remained to be seen whether everyone would be able to leave. Following a short presentation of awards to a truly international selection of AES members, I counted Polish, German, Chinese, Japanese, and Spanish names amongst the recipients, it was time for the keynote address. This year, it was given by Japanese music technology research scientist and software developer Masataka Goto, who demonstrated some of the technology he has helped to develop for identifying beat patterns and words in sung and spoken speech, and explained how these technologies could be used to refine our experience of listening to music. The beat recognition algorithms were demonstrated in a piece of video that showed a series of computer-generated robots locking onto the tempo of a piece of audio and then dancing in time to the music. The sung word recognition technologies could be used to skip through a musical track by clicking on the lyrics of the track. So, if you clicked on the third word in the fourth verse, the playback would jump to the point where that word was sung. Although that might sound unremarkable, when you think what the software has to be able to do to identify that word when it is sung, it's quite extraordinary. As with a lot of things you see at an AES show, I wonder whether we might see features like this incorporated into something like iTunes in the not-too-distant future. There was much I didn't get to see, such as the tour to the sound archive of the British Library. It was full, sadly, as they can only fit a few people in at once. It's now the morning of the second day, and I'm back in the press office, about to go and check out the exhibition hall, which has just opened.
So, just inside the entrance, I've found my way to the stand of DK Technologies, the Danish metering firm, who have something new here for us at the show. And here to tell me more about it is Andy Page, the UK representative of DK. Andy.
Hi. We've been working on loudness for quite a while now, and the loudness, actually the algorithms have been in the meter for a fair time now. Recently, Channel 4 decided that they were going to look at loudness for all their commercials. So for the last 18 months, we've been working with them developing software for our range of meters. And this has now been adopted by other UK networks, including ITV, Virgin, Redbee, amongst others. The new software that we're showing here today actually combines all the standard ballistics that people are used to, such as BBC PPMs,
sure.
But together with the new ITU 1770 and 1771 loudness algorithm. So on our display, we can have either stereo for standard commercials right up to surround sound.
Sure.
It's metered on the any of our range, so we start off with the basic two-channel MSD100, going right up to the new combined audio and video 760.
Right.
The new software is fairly unique in that you have the standard ballistics, as I mentioned before, mm-hmm. alongside loudness.
Sure.
You have your jellyfish and starfish surround sound.
See that
measurement
pulsing
tool.
Away there on the display? Yeah.
Yep. We have our loudness figure, which comes up as a numerical as well as a bar graph reading.
Yeah, sure.
And we also have a graph now, so the graph will give you historical loudness against time.
Right.
That's a kind of a moving window, so you've got, sure. on this particular instance, we've got a 3-minute moving window.
Right, excellent.
That'll give you a historical loudness over those 3 minutes, either a free running clock or using timecode.
I see.
In addition, for the broadcasters and monitoring their output, we've also got PC logging software. So you can log continuously for as long as you like, loudness output, and that can be exported as an Excel or a PDF to attach against media if necessary as well.
Right, sure, excellent.
And this is used pretty much all the way through the chain now, so the post-production companies, the ingest companies, such as IMD and AdStream use it, and then obviously the broadcasters themselves, and then the transmission companies are all monitoring the audio as it goes through.
Absolutely. So is this available as a free software upgrade or?
It comes as part of all our software packages on, sure. on the larger monitors. On the MSD100C, we've actually just released a new version of the software, which allows you to upgrade your current meter,
okay.
And that'll give you loudness and standard ballistics side by side on the screen. We're doing a special offer at the moment, so anybody who wants to go ahead with that can come by and collect a voucher.
Excellent.
And then they'll get it for half price.
Is that just valid at the show? Or?
It's well, you pick up the voucher and give us your email details at the show, and then it's valid for 6 months afterwards.
Terrific. Thank
Excellent.
You very much for your time.
No problem.
Cheers. Okay, so now I've arrived at the Rohde & Schwarz stand, and I'm talking to Klaus Schiffner from the company. Klaus, what's your position in the company?
I'm the product manager for audio analyzers
right.
for our company.
Excellent. And I understand you you have some new products in that field at the show here.
Yeah, we very recently launched a new family of audio analyzers.
Right.
We call them the UPP 200, 400, 800 audio analyzers.
Right.
Which are two-channel, four-channel, eight-channel instruments, mm-hmm. mainly designed to be used in manufacturing applications.
Right, I see. So for use on production lines, for example?
Yes, exactly.
Right, I see, yes. So, and presumably multi-channel for multi-channel tests, for example, in
right.
automotive use and so on.
For example, for automotive use, but also for some other applications where you need to measure more than two channels in parallel.
Simultaneously, yeah.
So the instrument do not have a display on the front panel. They also do not have any keys for manual operation, so they are mainly designed to be built in systems.
Right.
But because the PC is already built in, you simply have to connect an external monitor and a keyboard or a mouse, and you can operate this instrument manually, so it can also be used on the lab bench.
I see. So you could use control software with it, for example, like, I don't know, LabVIEW or something like that?
No, we have the software which operates the instrument, but of course it's based on Windows, so you
yes.
can export data and analyze them with other tools. That's
of course.
Possible.
I see. Yeah, excellent. And I assume from leaving the display off that the idea is this is to be a more affordable line of instruments than...
That's exactly the idea. So
yes.
we have on the market already for a few years the UPV audio analyzer, which mm-hmm. is the high-end model.
Yes, I see.
And the idea now is that companies can use the UPV, mm-hmm. for example, in their design departments, mm-hmm. while in the production lines where they want to save some money because they need lots of instruments in parallel,
Indeed.
They can use the UPP, the new family.
Yes.
Both instruments use the same firmware.
Right.
That means the setups are pretty much the same. Also, the remote commands are, most of them, exactly the same.
Right.
So if somebody designs a test software in the design department with the UPV, it will run on the UPP as well, as long as the same functionality is used. Because the UPP, the new box, is also reduced in functionality a little bit.
I see. So if there were functions that were designed for your higher-end products, they obviously would not work on that platform.
Yeah, you are exactly right.
Yes.
But, you know, usually in production lines, not so many parameters are tested, and quite often you also do not need the very high-end dynamic range or the high-end performance of the UPV.
No, it's a simple question of testing whether a device is fit for purpose and passing or failing.
Yeah. But you asked already a little bit about the price. So yes. If you would compare a dual-channel UPV with a dual-channel UPP 200,
yes.
You can see the UPP 200, the new box, is about half the price, of the UPV.
Right. Okay, I see. Obviously, the screen is missing. What other areas have you left out of the functionality in order to bring the price down?
With the UPV, we offer lots of options, mainly designed for, for example, type approval of mobile phone measurements, yes. High-end design measurements on hearing aids. All these things are missing on the new box.
Yes, I see. So very specialist applications have been left off.
It's more specialized for production applications, that's mainly. But all the other measurements, so let's say from frequency response up to FFT analysis, everything is in also in the new family of analyzers. So also here we provide a 256K FFT on this instrument. And when we are talking about the 8-channel instrument, it means that we really can measure 8 FFTs in parallel.
Yes, excellent.
Then you already asked about the automotive industry. Sometimes it happens that even 8 channels are not enough for them.
Sure, yeah.
High-end cars nowadays have up to 16 channels.
16, indeed, yep.
And sometimes we have been asked for even more channels.
Yes.
Now the solution is, with the new family of UPP audio analyzers, you can cascade these instruments.
Ah, okay.
That means you can combine a bundle of instruments. Mm-hmm. One of the boxes will be set to be the master.
Yes.
This master is the only box which have to be remote controlled by the system software from the production lines application.
And then that cascades
and
to the rest of the...
And this organizes all its slaves.
I see.
And because each of the instrument has its own PC built-in, you can measure up to 48 channels in parallel within the same time.
Excellent.
Exactly at the same time point, that means we even can do phase measurements between all of these different channels.
I see, yes.
So we do not have to export, let's say, raw data to the computer of the whole system. The whole analysis is done within the UPP analyzers and only the results are given to the main system.
Yes, I see. A networked selection of analyzers then, in other words.
Yeah, I would say it's the same quality. And Rohde & Schwarz is very well known for.
Sure.
Of course, these instruments are designed to run 24 hours to 365 days a year. No
in
problem.
Demanding factory conditions, yeah.
ISO 9000 certified and everything which is standard for Rohde & Schwarz.
Sure.
Where our company's name stands for.
Sure. Last of all, why did you choose the AES to launch the product line?
The AES convention always was a very important show. Mm-hmm. It's still one of the interesting conventions here.
Sure, absolutely.
That's the reason for us to be here. And the instrument is brand new. It fits very well for us. We launched this instrument about 4 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. From this time on, everything is available on the website,
yes.
RohdeandSchwarz.com, and here we can show it to everybody who wants to see it.
I hope you have an excellent show, Klaus. Thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Not everyone with a stand in the AES Exhibition Hall is showing new products. Prism Sound, who make high-end analog-to-digital converters, have taken a stand where they're showing their very high-end products, and also the Orpheus, their more affordable converter aimed at the Project Studio market. But they also have a presence in a separate seminar room with monitor manufacturer PMC near the main AES seminar rooms. Outside that hall, I managed to speak to Prism Sound co-founder Graham Boswell. I started by asking him why exhibit and take a separate presentation room.
We're here to see how the AES is evolving. AES still has an important place in the pro audio marketplace. And while we market very broadly now of individuals who are making music themselves at home or in small and modest facilities, there is still that market of professionals, what you might call the high-end market, and there's certainly a good concentration of people involved in that trade in this city. So the AES is a great forum for that. And at the same time, we are trying to bring a message to the AES community about the way we see the market changing, and that sort of indirectly delivered really by virtue of the presentations we're doing with PMC.
Indeed.
And we see that as something that builds on our own Mic to Monitor tour series of last year, both in the UK and the United States.
In which you went on a series of dedicated roadshows, didn't you? With,
yes, we did.
A number of celebrity producers and engineers, I believe.
Yes, the format was that we presented some technical sessions about recording technology with partner companies who represented the different stages in the recording chain, you know, hence the mic to monitor or mic to master, as we now call it. Title. So we had, you know, speaker people. We've had it on the mic to master tour, which has just started, kicked off in Plymouth a few weeks ago. We had SE Microphones doing something on microphones. But PMC have been a very strong partner for us for a long time. And this is a PMC event as opposed to a Prism Sound event, I should point out.
Sure.
But we're very happy to partner with them and join them on their events. And these events are very much local events. So we do a tour of the UK, tour of the United States, and we address a local market in the places where we stop. And we like to give some insight into the technology, enable people to understand the tools they're using, and we try to make it a little bit academic. So we hook up with universities often to provide a venue, and students often come along. We've had, you know, a number of universities actually offering course points or marks or credits of some form or another to students who attend our sessions, which is absolutely fantastic.
That's wonderful, yeah.
And as you say, we usually have a headline speaker of some note who will talk about their career and work in the recording industry. Mm. So by bringing, by taking part in PMC's series of talks in their a demo room here, we hope that we're delivering a message to the AES about how we see the market changing. So here we're really doing two things. We're talking to our local marketplace through the medium of these seminar sessions.
Yes.
And we're also talking to the AES's traditional high-end market. As well. And as you know, with the Orpheus product, you know, we're addressing that broad new market.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you're a classic example of a company that has made an offering available to that market, having formerly had very high-end, high-quality equipment, and of course still maintaining that, but with the Orpheus attracting a whole different class of audience.
Yes, I mean, it's within a price range, although it's expensive, and probably the most expensive sound card that you can buy. Mm. It's seen as very desirable. People understand its heritage and so on. I mean, we do make a great point of trying to promote that. Mm. But it is affordable within that marketplace to people who are committed and enthusiastic about what they're doing. I think, you know, we define our market as principally people who are either making their living out of music recording or aspiring to do that.
Absolutely.
And, so that... That on the one hand reflects that sector of the market, and then of course we've got the traditional high-end marketplace and customers a stone's throw from here, people like British Grove, Metropolis,
absolutely.
Abbey Road,
just around the corner,
represent that traditional marketplace.
Indeed.
So obviously we'll be expecting to see some of our acquaintances from that section of the market as well.
And
so
of course the BBC just up the road as well.
Of course the BBC, where we've got, getting on for 1,000 Sadie installations
absolutely.
As well. So,
absolutely.
All of those things very important to us. But I think, what we're really trying to do here, and the reason that we're here this year, and continuing to support the event, is to try to bring change and to... to work with the AES to refocus on this broader and more diverse market.
Thank you very much, Graham, and have a very good show.
Thank you, Matt.
Well, lunchtime comes to those who wait, and outside the hall I was lucky enough to run into Tom Williams and Dan Knighton from Audio Precision, who are also here showing a new audio analyzer, which from the sign on the stand I see is called the APX 515. Over to the guys. Dan Knighton is the product specialist at Audio Precision, who's looking after the development of the APX 515, and Tom Williams is the VP of marketing, and they're here to tell us more about it right now. Tom, what's different and new about the APX 515 as opposed to your previous analyzers?
Hi, Matt.
Hi.
The key thing that we saw was a lot of people trust Audio Precision. They want to have an Audio Precision analyzer, but sometimes it doesn't make financial sense if you're on a production line. So we thought, how can we get Audio Precision quality down at a production line price?
Gotcha.
We worked on it. The benefits of the APX platform is that we are able to take the technology that we used for our higher end APXs and put it into the APX 515. And what we've ended up with is a still pretty high performance audio analyzer, but at a production line price.
Gotcha. So I guess the burning question would be, in order to get that price down, what have you had to leave out from the more expensive APXs to do that?
The nice thing about APX is that the software is exactly the same. So whether you've got one of our 525s, a 585 with HDMI, or the 515, you're still going to have exactly the same functionality from a software perspective.
Gotcha.
What we have done is, for example, rather than being a higher grade chassis, we're using less expensive parts in the actual chassis. We've used, rather than it being a modular system where you can take the different in-out boards, it's one single board.
Okay, so things like your HDMI option, for example, wouldn't be available for this?
That's right, yeah. It's a single configuration. It's a two analog in and out and a digital in and out.
Okay. Do you have the option to expand to further channels?
No, that's the whole idea. What you see is what you get with the 515.
Okay.
If you need to have more functionality, like a digital serial interface or HDMI, then you need to look at our other analyzers.
Or if you had to go to multi-channel, like for
test
or something.
Yeah.
Okay, understood. So what prompted you to make this move? Dan, perhaps you'd like to answer this question.
Well, so Matt, a number of years ago I was traveling in China and South Korea and other parts of Asia because, of course, we have a number of customers there using our product.
Sure.
And what I discovered is there are some very large factories, fantastically large factories, churning out everything from refrigerators to MP3 players. And in these factories, rather than using our instrument to do the manufacturing tests and quality assurance of these products, what they'd actually do is they'd have one of our instruments, and they'd use it to test the instruments they're using to test the products. And those instruments would typically be some fairly old, very inexpensive, simple distortion analyzers, but they'd have hundreds of them. I mean, literally hundreds of them. Just in a dozen factories, I actually counted more than 500 variety of very old analog distortion analyzers. And when I spoke with the engineers about this, they said, well, you know, we like the Audio Precision brand. We trust the instrument a lot, but it's flatly too expensive. We can't buy 100 Audio Precision analyzers.
So while the core manufacturer might have one in their design department, their contract manufacturers are not able to spend that kind of money. Yeah.
And what we found is, furthermore, what's changed over time, what's changed very dramatically in the last 5 years, say, is that now it's very, very typical that any brand of electronics that you know of, what's really happening is that there's a core company that is designing that product. But in fact, it's going to be manufactured by a second company, an electronic manufacturing service or contract manufacturer, which may be domestic or overseas.
Sure, like the companies you saw in the first.
Exactly.
Right.
And there'll now be a very defined split and frankly, a difference of interest. The contract manufacturer, really, their goal is to make the product as cheaply as possible. They've agreed to make it for you for a certain price. So their profit margin is all about how to actually make it cheaper than that price.
Sure.
And of course, very often, the originator of that product is no longer directly testing that product.
Sure.
They may very well be getting something shrimp rack that's in fact directly shipped to a warehouse in some other country for delivery to consumers. So we found that there was more and more pressure to really trust that the measurements are correct, and that really doesn't exist when the designer is using one audio analyzer and the manufacturer is using a completely different audio analyzer, and moreover, they're separated by 8,000 miles of sea.
Sure, absolutely.
So really, that was the genesis of this product, was the idea of how can we serve that market for manufacturers of electronic audio devices.
And I'm guessing as well that if you can persuade people to do that, then one of the advantages would be that you're using the same audio analyzer in the design department as you're using at the test end.
Well, even more key actually is we wanted to create a family, because the R&D designer still has certain technical requirements. For example, they often need to be able to debug a product at the chip level, so they need to be able to communicate with it with I2S.
Sure.
But we wanted to have a lower cost product that was suitable for manufacturing, but where there was still complete agreement on measurement results. So you measure it with any of the APX products, or in fact any of Audio Precision's analyzers, you get the same measurement results. And then within the APX line, it's very easy. The designer can, in fact, configure a series of tests using whichever APX he happens to own, email that or deliver it by whatever method they want to the contract manufacturer and say, use this project, it'll produce a report. The design engineer can be assured that the results being achieved on the production line are the original results he specified.
Rather than them having to convert that test process for whatever analyzer
they might be using. And really there is no conversion process. What would happen very typically is the contract manufacturer would, you know, say that both parties had agreed the specification for this device is going to be minus 90 dB.
Sure.
So the design engineer has verified the design. Yes, the design produces that performance. The contract manufacturer says, yes, absolutely, it meets that performance criteria. Don't worry, Matt. And then what happens is...
Sounds reassuring, but...
Is that there begin to be product returns.
Right.
And then the design engineer gets called in and says, well, it turns out the product doesn't meet that performance. What is going on? And so the very first thing before anything can be squared away is, well, what does it mean? What results was the contract manufacturer achieving? What were they achieving it with? You know, was it meaningful in any particular way? And that will, you know, there'll be finger pointing going on. A huge amount of time can be wasted.
Sure.
Whereas the proposition that we're making is that there won't be any, that it will just be, if you got this measurement result at your lab, you will get, and you get this measurement result on your production line, and in both places you're using audio precision gear, it's the same result.
Sure, in other words, you have the same yardstick in both locations.
Exactly.
Right. So one question for Tom, how much is this product going to cost? You have a reputation for high quality, but it comes with a big price tag.
We're very proud to say $6,200 in the US.
Okay, yeah. Presumably that would be different in other territories, but...
Prices may vary.
Okay, that's great. So one final question for you. Why did you choose the AAS in London to launch the 515? Was it a simple matter of product cycle timing? You know, it was ready in time for the show?
The 515 is available now. It's going to be out actually in August.
Sure.
But the main reason is the AES is our home. We've been in this industry now for 25 years. It's our 25-year anniversary. The System 1 was introduced in the spring of 1985, and we thought it was the right place to introduce, which is a pretty significant new product for audio precision. We love the AES.
Well, thanks to both of you, and have a good rest of the show.
Thanks, Matt.
Cheers, Matt.
Not every exhibitor at the AES is a manufacturer, like DK Technologies, Rohde & Schwarz, Prism Sound, or Audio Precision. Some are distributors, responsible for representing companies from other countries. This year, Roger Klimo of SoundLink Marketing, from just outside the university city of Cambridge, is one of the largest UK distributors present at the AES, with a stand stretching across one aisle.
Roger, firstly, you have several brands here at the show, don't you?
Yes, I do. We're representing Microtech Gefell, the microphone manufacturer, which was originally Neumann Gefell. Well, still is Neumann Gefell. It's known as Neumann Gefell. Grace Design from the USA with microphone preamplifiers and monitor controllers. I represent ME Geithain, Music Electronic Geithain, also from Germany, which is a near neighbour actually to Gefell. And Trinoff Audio with digital room correction equipment, but latest off the block. And no doubt you'll talk to Trinoff people later.
Indeed.
They have a smart meter which now conforms with the latest P-Loud standards committee. So that's to be seen here on the show as well.
Good, yeah, we'll no doubt talk to Trinod later.
Yes, indeed.
Gefell aren't here at the moment, but perhaps you can tell us a bit about what they're showing at the show. I believe there are a couple of products that are new.
Yes, Gefell have got a couple of new interesting microphones. They've got the M1030, which basically is a development. It is a new capsule, but it's a development of the 930. Mm-hmm. But more of a design for the music recording studio than it is for broadcast. In broadcast, the 930... suits very well because of its small size for sight lines in those
discrete profile.
And the 1030 is designed much more for the music recording environment, and it has a few additions on top of what the 930 had. But
yeah, obviously, physical profile is not so much of a problem.
No, physical profile is not so much of a problem. You're quite right.
Sure.
They also have a microphone. It's called the Boonen microphone, or stage microphone.
Stage microphone, yep.
In English. And that's part of what they call the Micon series. Right. Micon series has actually been around for a little while, but it's been developed now with several useful variants of it.
Right.
It started off life as a table microphone.
Okay. And for the conference audio and that sort of thing?
Yes, that's right, yeah. Right. And also the capsules were used on the headphone microphone set, and the HSM 180 and 190 as well.
Right.
So it's a development out of that technology,
I see.
Really.
So to most people, when you say stage microphone, a dynamic microphone comes to mind, and of course Gefell are not particularly known for doing that sort of thing. Is it a dynamic capsule microphone? Or?
No, it's a condenser microphone. Gefell is not known for dynamic
microphones. No, indeed, absolutely.
So they're all condenser microphones, and there's two basic variants of it. There's the cardioid and there's the supercardioid variant. They're very, very small in size, and they're also discreet. The stage microphones are made with a dark bronze finish so that they can be hung and just about invisible.
Right.
But
yes.
Of course, in theatre type use, where sound reinforcement is not necessary, they can be used excellently for recording purposes without the audience being aware of their presence, even.
Absolutely, yeah. So, again, continuing that concept of a discreet microphone, but in a stage environment. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Excellent.
Yes.
Yeah. You're also representing Grace Designs here, who are
absolutely,
also
yes.
not here at the moment, so perhaps you can tell us something about, I believe they have two new products, is that right?
Yes, they've got two very interesting new products now. The first time ever that they've produced a channel strip, and the M103 is being shown here on the show, which is the first time in the UK that it's been shown.
Absolutely.
In fact, it's brand spanking new anyway, so not many people have seen it yet.
Excellent, that's what we'd like to hear.
It's a unit with which has got the usual Grace Design approach to it. The dynamic section, the compressor, is an optical element for compressing, so it's a very high quality unit.
Sure.
It's not going after that section of the market which is occupied by the likes of Neve with 33609s, etc. Because although I would say they distort a lot, their sound is well loved, but it's an artistic tool.
Indeed.
This is more of a recording person's tool in the Grace Design M103.
So quite a neutral.
Quite neutral in that respect, absolutely.
Yes.
It's got all the things that you expect of Grace now. All the switching elements are gold and sealed, and reed relays are used. Indicators for all the functions. Things like high-pass filter, when switched on, you see an indicator on the front panel.
It's not just a switch position, then.
It's
there's
not
some
just
sort
a switch
of indicator
position.
As well.
Yeah. Everything is indicated on it.
Excellent.
And like everything in the Grace stable, it all comes originally from Michael Grace, who's a very keen sound recordist.
But,
and basically he started to build things that he needed and he couldn't get elsewhere.
It's the best kind of product, that, isn't it, when somebody enthusiastic creates it from scratch.
Absolutely so.
But as you say, this is new because they've not done a channel strip before.
It's the first time they've done a channel strip.
It's essentially been mic preamps.
It's been mic preamps and monitor controllers.
And monitor controllers,
Is the two areas that they're into. The mic preamps, in fact, the 103 has the same front end as the 101. They haven't actually reinvented any wheels there. They had a good product and good technology, and they've used that. So 101's been around for about a year and a half now, and it's one of the best-selling products because it comes in at a good price point, which suits a lot of recordists. But the other thing that's been done is that same front end has now been ported into a new design called the M501. And the M501 is an identical circuit topology. It's the same thing, but housed in a 500 series rack. So it can go into the API lunchbox, for instance, so you can have your variety of different units.
So ideal for a producer who's on the road taking a small kit with him in a small rack.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. So, yes. Yeah. A very, very interesting product is the 802, which is the 8-channel strip. There's an 801 and an 802, but the 802 in particular is a very interesting one because it is remote controllable, and there's 8 in a 19-inch rack unit, and you can control up to 8 of those, so it's possible to control up to 64 on one control unit. What's more, they're using the Philips protocol for it, which means to say that standard things which people use, such as Pro Tools, can control it directly, just as though it were a Pro Tools interface.
Right, understood.
You can control it by MIDI as well, if you like. So it's got a lot of standard interfaces in there, which makes it flexible for installation.
That's terrific.
So that's on the preamplifier and channel strip side, but of course on the monitor controller side, that's another big area for Grace,
yes.
With the 904 and the 906 being equivalent, I would say, to the center section of a console, which answers
absolutely.
A lot of problems for people who are working with workstations, which might have an aux output or two, and they might have a monitor output on XLR, which you can listen to a limited amount of things.
Mm.
This is almost, I would say, completely replacing a console center section.
Absolutely, and therefore very, very handy for people working with DAWs, yeah.
Absolutely so. One of the very highly popular products, not only for the professional audio business and sound recorders, but also it's attracting more and more audiophile buffs, is the headphone amplilifier, the M902.
Right, so you've had some interest from the sort of top end of the hi-fi market.
Well, I've sold a few into the top end of the hi-fi market
right.
as well.
So tell us a bit about that.
Well, it's multiple inputs. It's got balanced and unbalanced inputs, AES3 input. It's got an optical input. It has a USB input as well, so you can use with laptops. It also has, besides the two headphone sockets on the front and the front panel level controller, it also has outputs for monitor amplifiers on the balanced outputs if you want them, or unbalanced if you want that way. There's a little extra charge for the balanced outputs.
I see. So very easy to integrate into a hi-fi system.
If the customer's got active loudspeakers,
yes,
but for the sound recordist and working where he needs to actually play back on some monitors that he has with him, for instance, he can play that back. There's modes on it, which means to say that the single front panel control can control the headphones. One press, you control the monitor loudspeakers.
I see, so you can switch between the different things that you're controlling the level of just by pressing the
you
the
can
in. Is that
indeed,
right?
Yeah. That's right. And by holding that button in, you bring up a little menu, and it's also possible, for instance, if you're listening to headphones, to mute the loudspeaker output and vice versa. So when you switch between them,
I see. So you can just switch solely to headphones and
absolutely.
Yeah, excellent.
And it has selectable crossfeed technology in it, which gives you a better sound staging as well, which again from that front panel control can be simply be switched in and out. Power on memory settings so that you can just hook it up and go. It's a very, very interesting device. I think it's
absolutely.
Going to go a long way.
Yeah.
We're demonstrating it here on the show.
Fantastic.
So people will be able to listen to it through some of the new Sennheiser HD800 headphones. And as a signal source, I'm using an SACD, which
very
is a recording with Microtec Gefell's UM75 Jubilee.
Very, very appropriate, encompassing everything that's
encompassing everything that I represent here, yes.
Excellent.
For my last interview of the second day, I returned to the entrance of the exhibition hall and spoke to two guys from Clearcom, the manufacturer of wired and wireless intercom and communication systems for live production staff. Their major launch at AES was HelixNet, a new unified intercom system which allows users of existing Clearcom systems to use them together with a new range of belt packs, base stations and headsets, which will grow over the next few months. HelixNet was announced at the NAB show in Las Vegas in April this year, but is getting its first showing outside the USA at the AES show. Dan Muchmore, regional sales manager for HelixNet in the UK, explained in more detail.
Well, HelixNet is a new age for Clearcom. Clearcom, going back 40 years in comms, originally originated from the live performance market. So the Clearcom name was synonymous with analog wired belt packs, analog wired panels, to which over time through company mergers we've grown to be wireless based technology as well as matrix based.
Sure.
So for a number of years now we've had an IP based
communication protocol
called
IV Core,
sure.
which is being used in our concert software. It's being used within our Matrix systems. We took the concept of analog wired technology and this IV Core algorithm that we have, and we married the two together.
Right,
sure. So now we're taking on the wired analog to the next generation.
Right, sure.
So Helix.
So would this be reverse compatible then? You could put older analog systems
absolutely.
Into it and it would work? Right, excellent.
Absolutely.
So hence the marriage, yeah.
Yes, absolutely. This is one of the important things of having 40 years of
sure.
install based. That sure. everything has to be backward compatible.
Absolutely, you absolutely.
Know, worst thing a company can do is alienate its
existing customers and
exactly.
customer base. Absolutely.
So HelixNet is the start, always going to be a network of products. So
right.
Helix, because of it's going to be the DNA of future products.
Sure,
to come,
sure, gotcha.
And Net for the network of
absolutely.
Products.
Absolutely.
So HelixNet starts off as a 4-channel base station
mm-hmm.
that supports 20 wired belt packs.
Mm-hmm.
And the beautiful thing about the IV Core technology is it's very fault tolerant. So you can run hundreds of meters of cable within the worst possible cable possible and still have very, very clear comms.
Sure.
So the algorithm for HelixNet is based on the sound shaping, if you like, of the ClearCom sound.
Sure.
So users of ClearCom analog will be familiar with
how to work it, and yeah,
they certainly haven't got a digital based belt pack, and it's alien to them.
No, sure,
the sound would be familiar. So, as I said, it's a 4-channel base that supports 20 belt packs. But earlier, you asked about how does it interface how does it interface with backward
sort of
compatible
older products, yeah, absolutely.
Well, on the back of the base station, there's 3 module slots
mm-hmm.
one module slot for 2-wire,
mm-hmm.
4-wire,
mm-hmm.
And for Ethernet.
Right.
So, its initial launch of HelixNet is it's a contained box.
Sure.
With subsequent releases, HelixNet will grow such that you'll be able to link multiple HelixNet base stations together to create a network of belt packs.
Right, the obvious question then is how far could you take that expansion? How many base stations could you...
It's IP-based.
Right, sure.
It,
so
you know, it becomes geographically unlimited.
Yeah,
as
absolutely.
Well, as
that's
well as
very
the core engine
sure.
Is used within our current concert software, is, and so which is hundreds of users. So
sure,
there is no
sure.
reason for it to... to be limited in any way. Each element of the Helix network is a node, and so more nodes will come, will follow. There'll be wall plates that you can mount into consoles, service mount onto walls, or into desktop enclosures. There'll be rack panels, so those used to our Encore product range, which are analog wired.
Sure, sure.
Actually, having a 19-inch rack panel to talk to. But the beautiful thing about a digital wired belt pack system as opposed to a wired belt pack is wired, you're limited to the channel you're connected to create the party line. With a HelixNet digital system, this is a 4-channel base, but each belt pack can manually select which of the 4 channels they wish to communicate to.
Absolutely.
So the belt pack is two channel talk and listen of the 4 channels.
Sure.
So we're moving away from this. Yes, we have a cable,
yep.
but we're moving away from this fixed position of cable.
Absolutely.
Channel.
And presumably also, I'm guessing that as it's an IP-based network, it's very easy to route one to many or many to one.
Absolutely.
You've got that kind of flexibility.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
The future of HelixNet is very open. The architecture
sure.
allows, at the moment, it's limited to a channel-based comms. The future allows it to become integrated as part of the IV Core network
sure.
with our Matrix and our concert software.
Sure, absolutely. So
it become point-to-point as well as group-based comms.
Excellent. So again, getting away from that idea of this particular handset is wired to this particular base station,
correct.
You should be able to just widen it and anything
absolutely.
To speak to anything else. Yeah, excellent.
Now, the design of HelixNet is also very important. The belt pack, it's taken off from generations of building belt packs.
Mm-hmm.
Listen to users to find out what they liked about the 600 series of the Encore
sure.
And previous. And so the belt pack is designed to be very, very rugged.
Mm-hmm.
We have a very large install base of party line in our theatre business, in live music, and in our offshore business as well. It's
sure.
very big. So everything from the 3-pin cabling up to the belt pack to taking, for it to be compatible with current infrastructure, to the actual rugged ability of the belt pack to withstand all sorts of abuse that one would get on a cable laying boat
mm-hmm.
to a theatre show. In summary, this is a product that's grown over 40 years of development. It marries digital technology with reliable wired technology. But the most important thing about HelixNet is it's taken on wired into the new to a new digital age, but also being sensitive to its current install base. So, you know, being able to integrate this in with a current two-wire system, sure. in with a four-wire system into a matrix, very, very simple.
Sure. So there's an open door for your existing
very open door, yeah. very important for us to have got through with the design of this product.
Also on the ClearCom stand were product specialists demonstrating a software upgrade to Tempest, an all-digital wireless intercom system. I turned to visiting US product specialist Gary Rosen to tell me more about that.
Gary. Tempest is a great product. It's a wireless intercom product. It's something very new. Wireless intercom has become more important over time,
sure.
and the intercom infrastructure is now obviously critical, whether it's a television shoot and the ability to tell a cameraman exactly where it needs to go, or, for example, I was at a very large rock concert in Amsterdam a week ago, Saturday, mm-hmm. and there they have pyrotechnics, they have sure. hydraulics. There it can even be a safety issue more than just production value cues.
Sure.
Somebody's in the wrong way when an elevator goes down, they could get hurt.
Yeah, that's not good.
So communications has become kind of critical. At the same time, traditional UHF communication was frequently the only avenue that was available. Mm-hmm. And over time, UHF has become more crowded for a number of reasons. First, 15 years ago, if you saw somebody on stage with a wireless microphone, it was unusual, moderate tech, and very good.
Yeah.
Now, if you see less than 15 people, it's unusual.
Yeah.
So the band crowding has gotten extreme.
Sure.
In addition, in the US and elsewhere around the world, where UHF was even allowed, it's become more problematic because of digital television, the reallocation of frequencies.
Sure.
So now we have a combination of crowding
yep.
and also
the spectrum's being taken away. We have the so-called digital dividend here in Europe, and you know the analog network's going to get switched off, basically. So.
That's exactly it.
Sure.
And so in some cases, for example, where we used to use wireless intercom and wireless microphones
sure.
was in the space in between the television channels.
Sure.
Well, in digital, there is no space.
There is no space.
It's wall to wall.
Sure.
So there's a lot of challenges. UHF is still a wonderful technology, offers a great deal, but we recognize the pressure on it and look to come up with what is, we believe, the next generation of intercom. So it's not just the reallocation of frequency, but it's a rethinking of what intercom can be.
Sure.
So our system, the Tempest, is a four-channel wireless intercom. It's also available in a two-channel system. Tempest has some very special technology, but to begin with, it broadcasts at a 2.4 gigahertz range.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things that happens is people frequently assume 2.4 equals Wi-Fi. Well, it's not. 2.4 is a frequency band. Wi-Fi is a very common thing to be broadcast in that band. We are in the same band, but we are not Wi-Fi. We are a completely different transmission scheme. And you can go to the ClearCom website. We have an RF guide under Tempest, which explains in detail. But effectively, it uses technologies like FHSS, frequency hopping, spread spectrum.
Right.
It uses redundant data transmission. It uses a number of things and a different type of transmission RF scheme
sure.
than Wi-Fi uses.
So essentially, then, you're not going to see any kind of interference, the kind of which you might have seen in the old analog days if something was transmitting on the same frequency.
Exactly. I call it a parallel universe. They live in the same frequency
yeah.
space, but they actually don't see each other.
Sure.
I'll take you in a bit when we're done with the interview, and I'll show you on the one of the tools we have that we're running right now in this facility at the AES. There's about 14 Wi-Fi hotspots that
right.
are running right now.
Right. And doesn't interfere with the ClearCom.
They don't
systems.
Know that we're on,
excellent.
And we don't know that they're on.
That's exactly the way it wants to be.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
So that's a little bit about the RF. And as far as understanding the system, we have some very interesting hardware implementation and some great software features. So first, the hardware. We have a base station, and the base stations are available in either two channels of intercom or four channels of intercom. And then we can stack multiple base stations. And depending on the configuration and what you need, we could have up to 6, 8, 10 base stations running all concurrently, all at the same time.
Right.
And the reason that we can do that is because a four-channel base station that also contains metadata, all of our, we have a number of special functions I'll explain,
sure.
and five users, all full duplex of four channels of intercom, is one frequency at a time.
Right, okay.
So now we can have multiple frequencies where in the UHF domain that would have taken at least 8 frequencies.
Sure, sure.
So very different there.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that allows us to use 5 or more users per base station.
Right,
also, when you're used to fully featured UHF, you're generally at a max of two channels on a base station and a max of four users. From there, we have alternate modes of operation. So for example, we have our normal mode, which is five users, four intercom channels, no restrictions. Then we do a split mode. And in split mode, we have four users, and then that fifth user, what would have been the user, and it's a TDMA system, that fifth timeshare user now becomes a open channel, single channel, for as many users as you wish.
Ah, but speak only, or
it is full duplex.
Oh, okay.
But only one of those users at a time can talk.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah.
So, for example, a lighting person rarely speaks; almost always listens.
Sure.
So now we could have 10 lighting people on one base, reducing the parts count, increasing efficiency, bringing cost down per user.
Sure.
Very cost effective.
Excellent.
So that's a great way of getting, as you say, the number of people on stage who now need to use these systems. That's a great way of packing them in there, essentially.
Exactly.
10 people perhaps on
or
the
20
unit.
Or 50.
Right.
And we call these mostly listening.
Right.
The non-critical users.
Sure, absolutely.
And then you still have four critical users.
Sure.
And then the next mode is called fully shared. And in shared mode now, we have as many people as you want. Up to four channels for everybody. They all select their own channels. But at the end of the day, there's a maximum of five talk paths at any one time. So no more than five people can speak at any one time, and anyone can speak if they're enabled to. The restriction there, of course, is that it is possible that if you had one of those, you might not be able to talk.
Sure.
So, for example, in some of the big concert tours, we see them using three base stations. Two give them 10 critical users,
sure.
Producer, director, stage
talk,
manager.
Receive at any time,
exactly.
No restrictions.
And then everyone else, 20, 30, 40, 50 people, have the ability now to share one.
Through the base station and
exactly.
Split.
Right. A2s rarely have to talk, A3s never have
sure.
to talk, and
sure.
you can disable that.
Sure.
So that's the system configuration.
Okay.
As far as I/O control, we handle two-wire, and very unique in that we can switch between ClearCom standard, RTS standard, and RadioCom, the Otelec standard. So any of those are compatible with our system without an external box. And then each of the intercom channels also can interface to four-wire. So we can select in a matrix how you want and what you need. So as far as a utility device, it has a great deal of utility, especially for an OB van that might have RTS and pull up to a theater that has ClearCom.
Cool, so it's looking backwards as well as forwards.
Compatibility.
Yeah. Sure.
The bell packs themselves are very unique, and although I know you're audio-wise, I'm going to let you hold one.
Okay.
And it's a rubber overmold. This
sure.
is manufactured for production.
Mm-hmm.
This is made to go through the rigors of production and punishment
sure.
that people use on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, absolutely. You can tell it's tough. It just feels it.
It's highly weatherproof.
Right.
We don't
okay.
say waterproof because
no,
people
okay.
will try to test it.
Of course, they'll drop it in a bath.
This could be out in a very severe rainstorm. And not suffer any consequences.
Sure.
We do things like a recessed power button, so you have to hold it for four
right.
seconds to turn it off.
So you're not going
to
switch it off in a hurry. Yeah, by
exactly.
accident.
Yeah. There's a menu-driven system. There are some very good production facilities. For example, a stage announce button, a call button that acts as if it's a wired pack.
Right.
It sends
okay.
and receives to the wire system.
Sure.
The power is very interesting. We supply it with a lithium polymer battery.
Okay.
It can run up to 9 hours on the battery.
Okay.
Again, because it's digital, that means you can talk for 9 hours.
Right, exactly.
Not just
yeah.
operate for nine
sure,
hours.
Sure.
That battery can recharge in 2.5.
Okay.
Should you run out of AC power, the generator goes down. Three AA batteries with no adapter will give you 4 hours of power. But again, if you don't have AA's, one other option on the side here is a USB port, and
okay.
you could plug that into your BlackBerry or even your laptop and it will operate.
Right, right.
Charging would be quite a bit slower.
Yeah, sure, of course.
But
of course.
You're on the air.
Yeah, absolutely.
By the way, the base station also can be DC powered.
Right.
Will run auto voltage from 11 to 32 volts DC.
Okay, excellent.
Okay. So it is a production level system that's
sure.
made to do the kinds of things that you're going to need to do. The last thing, and because this is the AES, this is actually very interesting. The company that builds this for ClearCom is CoachCom, very big in the U.S. sports market.
Sure, sure.
And they've really developed a system of understanding of what it takes to be heard. So as an example, in a college football game in the U.S., this is very big, it's like soccer
sure.
here, like football
yeah,
here.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they are frequently in a facility with 100,000 people screaming at the top of their lungs.
Sure.
How do you get over that noise? Well, noise-canceling headphones our one technique, but truthfully, they did some proper engineering here.
Right, okay.
So we supply a limited bandwidth 4K of audio for the human voice and instruction. It's well more than fine.
That's more than sufficient.
Because it's digital, there's none of the RF noise and garbage in the background and very good quieting. But most importantly, the system has greater than 90 dB of dynamic range.
Right.
Now,
that's almost studio quality. You know,
well, it is. But what does that mean in an intercom system? We know what it means on a CD.
Sure.
We know what it means in the studio.
Sure.
In an intercom system, what it does for us is gives us the ability to discern the close microphone from the far away distant sound.
Right, sure. So the stadium noise from the guy talking.
Exactly. So right. I have the ability to put on this headset, walk in front of a speaker array in a concert, and begin to talk without yelling,
right,
and begin to hear without my ears bleeding. So Tempest is a four-channel intercom, but clearly it's the next rethinking of what intercom should be.
Sure, understood. I've just got one last question for you, which is why did you guys choose the AES in London to show this to Europe for the first time? I know that there were some previews of this stuff at NAB in the States. Was it just a question of the product being right at the right time?
Well, Tempest, we had shown it several years ago. We were a bit delayed, and quite frankly, that's part of our lives. We all have suffered through this since day one, but I'm proud to say that our engineering staff has put out a product that is as robust as anything I've seen released, and I've spent many years releasing products in this industry. So the product is quite good. We actually began shipping just about a year ago. We had one showing at IBC. At NAB, we unveiled version 2 software, which enhanced features at no charge, added many new features.
That's the software update that adds the split mode, is it not?
That is split and shared mode, as well as a number of other things that we did.
Right, sure.
No charge enhancements to our customers. And the opportunity to be in the UK, I know AES has not been here in a long time.
Sure.
The opportunity to be here and be able to show it to everybody in the local market, how could you not do that?
Excellent. Great. Thanks very much, Gary. Thanks for your time.
Well, I'm back in the press office now, and it's time to call it a day for day 2. I'll be back tomorrow with more interviews from the exhibition floor.